coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly. Welcome back. On today's episode of Worth Doing Badly, we will survey the lessons for the Transfiguration of our Lord. And they are Exodus 34, verses 29 to 35, Psalm 50, verses 1 to 6, 2 Corinthians 3, verses 12 to 18, and chapter 4, verses 1 to 6, and the Gospel according to Mark, chapter 9, verses 2 to 9. Here is David Weber, followed by comments and questions from Ethan Stoppenhagen.
I'm often struck with a question as to what it means when we confess in the Nicene Creed to believe in all things visible and invisible. And I know, you know, the theoretical definition is that the real world is seen and unseen. It's spiritual and material. We are body and soul. The true, the good, and the beautiful in this life are both seen and unseen. So I know what it means, but what it means in a deep sense, I think, is conveyed by Mark's report on the transfigurations. I know that the reason why we confess this weekly is because we tend to reduce ourselves to the bodily and the material. Even though the Creed makes it clear that we are surrounded by divine mystery, and the mystery of God's presence. And this means that in this life, which we tend to reduce, we are forever and always bumping up against the eternal, the mysterious, the unseen, the forever. So, the Transfiguration, Mark's report does not try to explain this. He just gives us the details of what took place. And in those details, the meaning of the mystery of Christ's incarnation is presented to us. This is the event that in which God is establishing his real and supernatural presence on earth in our lives, and it culminates in the cross. So of the many details that are reported in this text, I'll focus only on three. Because they're very suggestive, but they're not clear-cut definitions. The first is the intensity of Jesus' clothing, the presence of Elijah and Moses, and finally Peter's misinterpretation of the event. All right, so Mark records that Jesus' clothes became white with an intensity like nothing on earth. Now, what could be more earthly than color and clothing? But whatever happened at the Transfiguration transfigured the commonplace into the extraordinary so that Jesus' clothes were like nothing on earth. Now, why is color or its absence, the intensity, a sign of the mysterious when color is very common and utterly unmysterious? The commonness of Jesus' clothes had an otherworldly intensity, which I think casts light on what the incarnation is. It's not starting totally over. It is taking what is common and intensifying it with a life that is bright and white and which makes what we call bright and white only a faint and dingy copy of the eternal brightness. So the Transfiguration is making it clear that the best of worldly brightness is at its best only a shoddy and tattered imitation of the eternal reality that Christ is establishing on earth by his suffering and death. Now, I have to admit that I have read artists and heard lectures, artists and phenomenological philosophers talk about the mystery of color. It's something that I'm attracted to. And I have to say, I almost never understand anything that they have to say, which is weird because what could be more common than color? But artists and these phenomenological philosophers see something other than just superficial color. There's something in color that is conveys the depth of who we are as human beings and what we long for. Mark reports of the intensification of color at the Transfiguration, which revealed the glory of Christ's coming suffering and death. Now, that's weird to talk about suffering and death as a glory. But it is the glory of this coming suffering and death is it transfigures the disfigured mortal flesh of Jesus. And it turns what is tainted by sin, death, and the power of the devil into an eternal brightness, the eternal brightness that we long for. So the intensity of Jesus' clothing captured the truth that what we call life is hopeless, that there's a desperate hopelessness even in the best life can offer, because compared to what we truly desire, the eternal we truly desire, everything is but a dingy knockoff of the true life. And in order for us to have this desire satisfied, we need the intervention of eternity. The next sign of the meaning of the Transfiguration is that two towering Old Testament characters, Elijah and Moses, are mysteriously present. We're not given an explanation. We have to kind of speculate. So I wonder if it's not so much, they weren't there not so much because they were towering, but because they were failures. Both suffered a despairing hopelessness soon after they experienced towering success. Having completed the Exodus and receiving the Ten Commandments, Moses then disobeyed God. So that, as Numbers said, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them. Now, at the Transfiguration, Moses has finally gained access to the Promised Land. He's admitted to where he had been prohibited. And obviously, Moses is there because what he had to offer was to point to Jesus, and that he was only a sign to something greater. And Paul will speak to that. Elijah, of course, worked in the Promised Land, but he did not experience the promise. He was working at a time when it was a divided kingdom. And it was divided by religious unbelief and political corruption. And after his victory over the prophets of Baal, and which I think pleasingly angered the wicked monarch Jezebel, Elijah fled into the desert, despairing because he thought God had left him alone. So again, Mark just reports that two prominent characters who were prominently hopeless in the Old Testament were present at Jesus' sacrifice, because that sacrifice is what gives the hope that was missing in their lives. Lastly is Mark's report on Peter's misunderstanding of the Transfiguration. Peter failed to understand the Transfiguration because he could not see how it connected to Jesus' coming disfiguring sacrifice. Peter did not understand the meaning of glory, the glory of salvation, that he thought that glory was on full display in the Transfiguration. He did not see that the glory of salvation is that it takes the disfigured, we who are disfigured by sin, death, and the devil, and promises the transfiguration of our lives. And when Peter was faced with the brutal disparity between the transfigured Jesus on the mountain and the disfigured Jesus on the cross, he lost hope. He was hopeless. Now, again, the reason why hope is figuring into all of this is because of the epistle lesson where Paul is speaking of the problem of hopelessness and not losing hope. So then, like Elijah and Moses before him, Peter was restored. Having recognized the coherence of the glory of the Transfiguration is the same glory that was revealed on Christ's cross and verified in the resurrection. This was the glory of the mystery of the incarnation, where the dingy and dismal sin-stained world is luminously brightened by the sacrificial blood of the Lamb. Having said this, I will admit to being unconvinced that I will be able to speak intelligibly about the mystery of the incarnation, even though I love the imagery of the dingy color being brightened and fallen characters being restored. And whatever else will be said, because it's a mystery, much is left unsaid, because saying things isn't going to get at the heart of the mystery. How do we speak of that which defies being put into words without sounding like muddle-headed charlatans? I'm not naturally a mystic, and I'm oftentimes put off by people who claim to have mystical experiences, and yet all the church fathers call this the mystery of the transfiguration, which is to cast light on the mystery of the incarnation. So I think we avoid trying to unscrew the inscrutable by rather recognizing that the event comes to a point when God says, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." The point is not a theory of interpretation of mysteries, but it's rather an invitation that if we are going to participate in these mysteries, it happens through the mundane regularity of listening to Christ through his word. And it's only by entering into the regularity and mundaneness of that word that we are promised to enjoy the fruits of the mystery of the incarnation. It just happens through listening. And like a thud, Ethan, that doesn't feel like it captures at all the energy of the transfiguration.
So do you think part of our task as preachers is to foster a curiosity in the mystery rather than trying to explain it, I guess?
Well, I know that it can't be explained, but tell me more about what that would be, to be curious about mystery.
I think it would mean seeking, like you said, seeking a participation, in some ways fostering a sense of awe and wonder. You know, I think of Abraham Heschel talks about how, in one of his essays, that so much of the world is concerned with creating a sense of belonging. And he says that's wrong. You know, it's not about creating a sense of belonging. It's about creating a sense of awe and wonder in something greater than oneself.
That makes sense. Of course, Rudolf Otto is, you know, a Lutheran who recognized this, that we're being introduced into mysteries, right?
Right.
And what I like about the idea that once you will admit that the world is not scientifically explicable, but that we are always bumping up against these mysteries, and as long as it doesn't go off into, you know, some kooky theory, that invites us to look at reality with different eyes. And I like the old distinction in Plato that we're going to experience this mystery in terms of the truthful, the good, and the beautiful. And when we get to the psalm, it's the beautiful in which the mysteries are experienced, right? So, and those things are called transcendentals because they run through. They will never lose currency. They will always be the things that human beings desire. And of course, you know, the early church fathers thought that what Plato had written about, Jesus had come to fulfill. But again, if we talk too much about it, mysteries are things in which words introduce us, but they don't take us very far. As you say, that depends on a curiosity, or I think it's a desire that God reveal himself and reveal this other world that's, you know, right next door to us.
Would you say that we have that desire inherently?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's tamped down. I think we learn to become materialists. very early on. And I think in the modern world, we become, because the material world has been so gratifying in what it has reveals, and God has invested the material world with all sorts of brilliance to lead us to Him. But somehow it's the very thing that stops us from desiring more of His presence. Again, if we say much more, it's going to be traipsing over a well-trod territory. But I do think that the minister who gets up there has had experiences. And oftentimes it's an experience within worship. And the problem is that people who have had this mysterious worship experience want to try to duplicate it on a scheduled way and then expect others to have that same experience. And it becomes kind of a new form of tyranny rather than freedom. But that's something completely different. The Psalms are full of the psalmist coming to the borders of mystery, recognizing that they're just on the other side of a gossamer veil. There is a different world. And in the Psalms, eternity is not something that's in the future. It is the thing that time is enveloped in. God isn't waiting for us at the end of life. The real presence is everywhere. And so having a connection with that is our desire. So the psalm is celebrating creation's perfection. And that perfection for the psalm is evident in our experiences of beauty. And what is beauty? I mean, it's a word that's misunderstood. It is the thing that draws us. You could call it attraction. And it's always impressed the minds of people that it is possible in this world not to have to be driven or commanded or scolded into action, that there is a way in which we are drawn, in which we are lifted up, and that's the whole principle of beauty, and that's what's on display in the Transfiguration, that Christ is drawing us to the beauty of salvation. And then the surprise is that it becomes very unbeautiful in the crucifixion. This is Peter's problem. He couldn't understand that the beauty of the Transfiguration was there, was confident that it could lift us out of the disfiguring power of sin, but would have to do that by entering into sin. So for Peter, Jesus' suffering and death was the absolute abolition of the hope of salvation that he had experienced in the Transfiguration. Jesus should have been sort of said well enough and stayed on the mountain rather than going into Jerusalem. Peter was despaired and offended, scandalized by Jesus's move to the cross. How could something so ugly be the desired perfection of beauty, as the psalm says? He did not see how the perfection of beauty would be achieved by sacrifice. And that's what the psalm is making clear, that the beauty of creation comes to us a culminating point in sacrifice. Now, who sees sacrifice as beautiful? The recipients. We do. If we don't see that this sacrifice is an expression of utter love, if we don't see the beauty in the sacrifice, which was eclipsed for Peter, then we are missing the point of the Transfiguration. So Peter didn't need a theory of atonement to understand the Transfiguration. He rather had to come to appreciate that Jesus would penetrate the utter depths of ugliness in order to establish on earth the path to the perfection of beauty. Now, sadly, in our congregation, we don't pray the psalm, and so this is lost, but it's still as part of the atmosphere of the pastor's preparation to have this idea of the perfection of beauty in the background, I think gives depth to our appeal to the Transfiguration as this establishment of God's beauty on earth and through the sacrifice of Jesus. Now, the psalm declares that the beauty of this world is that our God comes, and his coming is that he does not keep silence. So we come to the same thing that the gospel ends with, that there's something in God speaking to us in which the beauty of his creation is imparted. The spoken word that first summoned the earth in creation comes to us as creatures in that creation. And that word, in some mysterious way, puts us on and keeps us on the path of perfection, which is the beauty that draws us to this eternal life. We get another experience in Exodus with Moses, in which it's reported that his face glowed after he was in the presence of God. So we've asked, what does the presence of Elijah and Moses at the Transfiguration mean? And as Mark doesn't tell us, we surmise, and as I've said, that Elijah and Moses, who were intimately familiar with God's presence, Elijah and maybe Moses was taken up into God's eternal presence without suffering death. And yet, in spite of their important victories, they did not experience the fullness of the promise of the promised land. And so they were there. Now, what makes this Exodus passage so interesting is what Paul will say in the epistle about Moses putting a veil over his face that glowed after being in the presence of, in God's presence. So Paul puts it this way. We do not lose heart. We do not lose hope, right? Because the loss of hope is unavoidable without Christ's sacrifice. The beauty of the Transfiguration is that it shines a light on the hope that is coming because of Christ's sacrifice. Now, strangely, I think, brutally almost, Paul presents Moses as exemplifying hopelessness. That's pretty brilliant. There is no a hero worship for Paul. If Moses is wrong, he's going to be brilliantly wrong. And so he exemplified this worldly hopelessness when he veiled his face to hide what was being brought to an end. Moses understood that the law was brilliantly enlightening. It's a lamp and a light in the dark path. But the law is limited. And Moses, according to Paul, had a hard time admitting that his law had its limits. The radiance of the law is real, but not eternal. And so it is inevitably disappointing because it cannot fulfill the human desire for the perfection of beauty. But Moses gave it his best try. He tried to veil the truth that the law can never fulfill what it promises and what it points to, and that without the hope of Christ's sacrifice, which opens the way of perfection to beauty, we are stuck in the hopelessness that was experienced by Elijah and Moses. And Paul goes on to say, those who are hopeless have to resort to disgraceful, underhanded, and cunning tricks to distract and disguise their hopelessness. That's how Paul interprets Moses' veil. It was a cunning trick to disguise the truth. Now, Paul's high view of God's grace and forgiveness, I think, sanctions such brutal truthfulness. It is not dealing with Moses with veneration, rather than because Moses is forgiven like we are forgiven, it frees us to deal with the failings with much more truthfulness. And this is why I think we see Moses and Elijah at the Mount of Transfiguration. So I wonder, does Paul think that we shy away from the truth of hopelessness, which, as the psalm puts it, is the thing that gives up on there being a path to the perfection of beauty? I think that when we give up on expecting God to manifest his mysterious presence to us, that we are making ourselves content with mediocrity and imperfection and the dinginess of this life, rather than entering into the disfiguring suffering and death of this world as Jesus entered into it. Not to see if, in fact, it is the nullification of the perfection of beauty or whether it can transfigure even the worst of this world. I think we fear what Peter feared. He saw a banality in Christ's suffering. He saw that this should not happen in a world that is just and filled with God's presence. It all seemed, for Peter, Jesus' suffering seemed cruelly meaningless, absurd, and accidental. And yet the Transfiguration said it's the opposite of that. It is the first revelation of the glory of salvation. So Paul explains that Jesus' descent into the darkness did not extinguish the light, but it rather distinguished that Jesus is the only light that can lead us out of the darkness of hopeless despair. And the hopelessness that Paul warns of comes when we experience life's absurdity and accidents. Now, we said earlier, Ethan, that we can't predict when we're going to enjoy God's mysterious presence, but we can predict that all of us are going to suffer life's absurdity and accidents. All of us, because all of us are going to suffer. And so the promise of this is that in those moments of suffering, the absurdity of life and the dinginess of sin, it's at those moments that God's presence is most importantly experienced. So I do wish our talk of Christ's sacrifice didn't sound so empty and cliche, but I think that's unavoidable, because it's not until the single individual experiences the ugliness of sin that even threatens their very hope that they see that they experience and see that Christ's transfiguration leading to his death and resurrection established truly the path to the perfection of beauty. And this is why Paul is confident. This is why we do not lose hope. Even when we experience dying in this life. And this is why I like the Transfiguration is a doorway by which we enter 6 weeks of Lent, in which we contemplate the ugly power of sin and the hope of redemption.
Thank you, David and Ethan. And thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.